Peterson.
Patterson.
Good morning. May it please the court. Casey Granis, representing petitioner David Patterson in this personal restraint proceeding. I'll reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Patterson challenges various conditions of confinement. As a threshold matter, the PRP is a proper procedural vehicle to bring these claims before this court. The DOC has argued that Patterson should be required to bring a Section 1983 action before being able to bring a PRP to challenge the conditions of confinement. This court's decision in In Re Personal Restraint of Arsenault is directly on point and refutes this, the DOC's argument. In Arsenault, this court held that the petitioner need not bring a 1983 action before challenging a condition of confinement by way of a PRP. With that procedural issue out of the way, I'll turn to the merits of Patterson's petition. First, I'd like to turn to the cruel and unusual punishment claim. Mr. Patterson, while confined at the Monroe Correctional Center and then upon transfer to the Washington State Penitentiary, was deprived of outdoor exercise for a continuous period of 7.5 months. That is a violation of the Eighth Amendment under the case law, where the deprivation of a humane condition of confinement violates the Eighth Amendment, has two prongs, an objective prong and a subjective one. Both those prongs are met here. Again, under the case law that I've cited, Keenan, Lopez, Allen, etc., 7.5 months meets the objective prong of that test.
What relief can this court give for a condition that no longer exists? He's out of the intensive management unit. He's in general
right.
population now.
Right.
So what relief could this court possibly give?
There's no effective relief that this court can give Patterson at this time.
So why are we talking about it?
The briefing recognizes that this issue is moot, technically,
okay.
but that this court should still reach it because it, one, it's capable of repetition yet evading review, and two, it presents an issue of substantial public importance that should be decided by this court. Yes, Patterson is out of the IMU unit at the penitentiary right now. Plenty of other people are, always in the in that IMU unit, IMU South at the penitentiary, and are subject to the same condition of being deprived of outdoor exercise as a routine of their confinement. This is a categorical deprivation, and this court should step in and hold that it is a violation of the Eighth Amendment to prevent this violation from reoccurring and being inflicted upon other people. This is just a physical problem that IMU South, I understand it just does not have facilities made available to petitioner or to inmates who are housed there for outdoor exercise. The DOC has argued that while they're seeking funds to provide that facility, that outdoor exercise facility, they haven't gotten yet a holding from this court that this is a constitutional problem, might just jumpstart that process of getting the funds needed to actually satisfy the state's constitutional obligations in this case. In terms of just one last comment on the cruel and unusual punishment claim, the subjective element of the cruel and unusual punishment issue, that requires that the officials in charge know that the problem exists, basically, a knowing deprivation. And in this case, there's no dispute that officials knew that they didn't have the outdoor facilities for exercise. I also like to turn, Patterson raises a variety of First Amendment claims as well, relating to confiscation or rejection of various materials that were mailed to him. I'd like to first turn to the confiscation of the slip opinion issued by the United States Supreme Court in a death penalty case. That was sent to him by his federal lawyer, and that was confiscated by the DOC staff. And that's a violation of Pedersen's First Amendment right. We look to, the test that we all know of is the Turner test. It cites various factors. We look at those factors, and on balance, they favor Pedersen. I mean, this is the situation where the DOC allows all sorts of materials to be mailed to inmates. And in this particular, for this particular issue, Pedersen was in general population at this time when this event arose. And DOC routinely screens for the personal mail that is being sent to inmates. There's no reason why that same type of screening can't be applied to the an opinion from the court. Just recently, I mailed the decision of this court's decision in Lightroth to a client because I wanted to inform him that hey, there may be potential for relief here. That wasn't rejected by the facility. So to show that this is a means to communicate with inmates valuable information, and if this court were to hold that lawyers can't send copies of court decisions to their clients, that is a problem. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Assistant Attorney General Candy Dibble, and I represent the department in this matter. We're asking for the court today to dismiss a large majority of Mr. Pedersen's claims because they're not properly brought forth as a personal restraint petition. Under the Supreme Court's decision in N. Ray Sappenfield and under RAP 16.4D, a large majority of the remedies that he's requesting through his personal restraint petition are not properly brought before this court. And under the decision in N. Ray Sappenfield, the Supreme Court held that the only thing that basically the court can do through a personal restraint petition is remove the unlawful restraints. Several of the remedies that he is seeking through this are declaratory and injunctive. He's asking for this court to basically return items to him to require that the department undergo additional training. He's asking for this court to make decisions on past actions that don't involve his ongoing conditions of confinement. They're one-time issues that were problematic for the department. And that those claims should have been brought forth in a civil action, as the Supreme Court has held in N. Ray Sappenfield. And that is what ends up clouding a large majority of this personal restraint petition, because the department is having to spend resources and respond to allegations which it has no real avenue to present any defense to this court on.
But the department could put in a declaration, for example, saying, we didn't open his legal mail. Why didn't they?
Because they don't know the evidence.
They don't know whether they were opening his legal mail? How could they not know?
Some of the claims that he brings forth, we've got no evidence that ever occurred. And in fact, he provides to this court, and really it's his burden under N. Ray Cook and N. Ray Rice to present evidence. And the only thing he brings are conclusory allegations, or he attaches kites that the copies that are provided were illegible. When I sought opposing counsel and asked him if he had better copies, he did not, right? And that therein lies part of the problem with the discovery in this case and how I have no avenue to figure out and to narrow his claims. Because he had ongoing correspondence with his legal counsel for several months while he was in DOC custody. He indicates through his personal restraint petition that I believe it's two or three times that his legal mail was confiscated. I don't know how many times out of those several months which confiscations he's specifically targeting, which ones he's talking about. So it's difficult for me to bring up a declaration that says, we don't think we do, but we really don't know, because we may have not. And so it's difficult for the department to even address some of the claims that he brings, because I don't have an avenue to really narrow the claims down and to be able to properly respond and to provide evidence to this court. And I think, too, it really confiscates things for opposing counsel, because he's assigned in this case. And when you read his reply, it's clear that he doesn't have a full understanding of what exactly is going on either. So, for instance, when we talk about exhaustion of the grievance process, he indicates that he wrote some kites or that in certain places that letters were okay for that. They weren't, because if you read the offender grievance program and you look at the policy and you also look at the case law that requires exhaustion of that, merely writing kites and not following the prison's grievance program doesn't count for exhaustion purposes. He also confuses, and this is purely because we don't have the opportunity to have full discovery in this case. He confuses the fact that he believes that there's, and not necessarily that he believes that there's one Gonzalez that works for the Department of Corrections, but he confuses the declaration that we submit from Roy Gonzalez that works at headquarters that's in charge of legal access and that can provide information to this court with the officer Gonzalez that worked out in Walla Walla that confiscated the photographs. And what happens is that our briefing ends up not being relevantly clear to this court. It makes it difficult to narrow down the issues, and it makes it even more difficult in light of the fact that the U.S. Supreme Court and the Ninth Circuit has indicated that the court needs to proceed with caution when they're looking at and making decisions on internal prison policies and regulations. And so it's when I say it's difficult, and especially because I believe he brought 9 claims, for me to properly respond to that and provide evidence to this court that this may or may not have occurred through a personal restraint petition is, in essence, unfair to the department. We need to be able to answer to those, and if I can't depose him and I can't get information from him, it makes it difficult in order for me to even provide a proper response to this court for that. Are there any other questions? Okay. If not, I'll go ahead and sit down unless you would like me to. No? Okay. Thank you.
I'd like to first turn to the legal mail issue. There are essentially 2 main claims related to that. One of them has to do with this confiscation of Pedersen's marked legal mail in December of 2014. Pedersen, in his sworn PRP, details what happened on that day. And
with regard to the department's policy on this, isn't it a reasonable exercise of their authority to require that they be stamped legal mail and have the institutional number on it? I mean, it wouldn't, given the number of folks that they have to manage, aren't those reasonable requirements?
Well, focusing on the stamped legal mail, certainly I agree with that, and that Pedersen's claims are focused on those instances where DOC confiscated or intercepted his legal mail. That was clearly marked as such. In terms of whether it's a reasonable requirement that the inmate number be on a piece of mail, generally speaking, I would agree with that as well. But
so, what is the complaint here that for which we could grant relief? And then, with regard to the legal mail,
well, for the legal mail, that was confiscated from him and never returned to him. So Pedersen is asking for it back.
Does that still have it?
Does DOC still have it? If that's DOC, I don't know what they've done with it. All we know is that Pedersen doesn't have it.
Well, then how do we know that we can grant that relief? The term used is effective relief, not hypothetical, right? So if we don't know that they have it, and if it seems unlikely that they would keep it around,
well,
where are we?
I don't know about that. I mean, we have information in the record that shows that this legal mail was transferred to the intelligence unit of the the intelligence unit of the DOC, something that they marked it as, you know, significant and special to look into. It seems to me that that heightens the prospect of that mail still actually being in existence. But more to the point, though, Your Honor, is that
do you have a civil action for conversion?
I don't know. I don't know if he does, but the point that I'm trying to make here, or trying to get to, is that the reason why we don't know whether DOC still has the legal mail is because DOC has refused to offer a reply on this issue. Pedersen raised the claim. I'm looking at the DOC's declarations in response, and there's nothing on there on this.
He's got to raise a claim, and he's got to tie his complaint to relief that can be granted, right? And I fully understand the position you're in, and we appreciate the fact that you discharged your responsibility and you didn't get to do the initial pleadings. It's not like a regular appeal where you get to pick the issues and do it. We totally get that. Mm-hmm. So with that understanding, we still have to be able to look at it and see legal argument, facts, and relief that all appear that one can follow from the other. I mean, right?
I agree with that.
I mean, we can't just give hypothetical orders. If you still got it, that gets us nowhere.
Well, I don't know about that. I mean, a conditional order, if it still exists, return it to Pedersen. I don't see the roadblock to that. And this is a situation where Pedersen has raised enough of a claim to establish prima facie basis for relief. If there is a question about whether the DOC still actually has the legal mail in its possession, that's something that can be hashed out at a reference hearing.
What county?
Well, this is out of...
Convicted in Snohomish County, housed for a time in Snohomish County, housed now in Walla Walla County. Who gets the reference hearing?
I have to look at the wraps for that, Your Honor. I can't remember the top of my head.
If you do, let me know. I already have, and I don't know who gets the reference hearing with that setup.
Which
is a cause for concern, yeah.
Well, not to belabor the point, sure. But that's an issue in every PRP where you send it back for a reference hearing. Where does it go back to?
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.